we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
People, for the next segment on Pulse, I'm absolutely thrilled that in a recent trip to Ohio, I had the distinct pleasure of meeting one Brooke Jackson. You'll know her as the FISA whistleblower. Maybe you don't know about her, but her work has been featured on Children's Health Defense. Her experience has been chronicled on Trial Site News. There's an audio interview there by Sonia Elijah, as well as other places. People in the BMJ have been talking about her and her experiences at
Ventavia
trial site. Now, Ventavia is a research organization that conducts clinical trials, and they were contracted by Pfizer to conduct some of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine trials. How are you today, Brooke? Thanks for being on the Pulse.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to tell my story.
Yeah, absolutely. So just briefly, tell us your background. You know, you have like 20 years experience in clinical trials research. How do you train for clinical trials research? What is that experience like?
That's a good question. You know, I'd say over the past, 10 plus years that there are degrees in clinical research. But when I started, my, it was all on the job experience. I actually started my career as a clinical researcher, being a clinical trial participant myself. I was doing a clinical research study, wanting to be a pharmacist, and was offered the position after my participation by the principal investigator of the study, who I believe is still the dean of minority affairs at our teaching school here in Dallas, UT Southwestern, and worked through one of their hospital systems, the Dallas VA Medical Center, and was there for about 10 years. So really most of my experience came from there.
Yeah, right on. Do you have any particular degrees that you'd like to mention?
No, not really. I mean, I have, just basic associate's degree. I found that, in my schooling, it just wasn't my thing. And I was very successful in, moving up in my career through being a research coordinator, then moving into clinical trial management, and became a director of operations. And that's where, I gained so much experience at the site management or clinical research, contract research organization level. And, did that for about 5.5 years. And the travel just became so much that I was looking for something local. So I just, got on one of the job boards, and that's how I came to Ventavia Research Group. The travel became so much that I was just looking for something that was local, where I could, stay closer to home.
Okay, so anybody who's met you become quickly very impressed with, your business-like demeanor, your intelligence. You have an innate intelligence. And so I can see very quickly where, you'd be able to stay focused on the task at hand. And those tasks in clinical trials research, they have established practices. They have established best practices. And so rather than ask you what went wrong, I want to start with what should clinical trials research look like if you're doing it well? Let's go, say, to the Pfizer vaccine trial that was being conducted, the arm of the trial that was being conducted by Ventavia.
What it should look like, organized chaos, because it can become very busy, in these high enrolling, quick clinical trials. If you have the infrastructure, if you have, your business set up to run appropriately, it can be done. I've seen a lot of information out lately about, how can these clinical trials enroll so quickly? And like I said, it can be done. It has to be a well-oiled machine, but it can be done. But that's really, in my experience at Ventavia, walking in there, that's what they lacked, the space to conduct the trial, the experienced clinical research staff to manage the patients, and the principal investigators, they were never there. I met the principal investigator at one of my sites twice in, the few weeks that I was there, where he should have been there on a daily basis. So
sure, those are things that went wrong, but sort of, you know, if you were running clinical trials, you had a checklist in your mind, you'd have to have proper informed consent.
Absolutely.
Right. These kinds of things. Yes. You would have specific record keeping practices.
Oh yeah. All of the standard operating procedures, you know, that I asked for even before starting at Ventavia, just so I could familiarize myself with their practice. And when I started going through these documents, and you know, there are many, there's an informed consent process, there's, you know, I mean, the list just could go on. I recognized that these SOPs that they had for the conduct of research were actually written for a completely different company. The company's name was listed in their own SOPs. So that was one of the things that stood out to me. you know, when I started looking at resumes of the staff, it just didn't make sense why they were in the positions that they were in. You know, our emergency medications, our crash cart wasn't easily accessible. You know, when I started going through the list of medications, recognized, you know, they were expired. We were missing epinephrine. It shocks the hell out of me that they're actually still up and conducting clinical trials.
Sure. So one of the things that you've reported elsewhere, one of your allegations is specifically that the clinical trial staff were unblinded to the patient's vaccination status, whether they received whether they were the control group or in the treatment group, whether they received the placebo or the actual mm-hmm. vaccine, because the randomization scheme was placed on every participant's chart. So explain that to the listeners here and why that's so important.
Yeah, well, so for this particular study design, it was, you know, what we consider the gold standard in that it was blinded to all of the clinical trial staff, including the study doctor that was over the trial. What Ventavia did, and I don't think this was purposeful, but when we realized what we'd done, it was an immediate rush to cover it up. So once a patient was consented and it was determined he or she was eligible for participation, they are randomized to either receive placebo or the actual active vaccine. And that's done through a system called IVRS. So once that patient's randomized, we go into a system and they're randomly, like, you know, assigned to the vaccine or placebo. And it prints out a scheme, you know, what they were assigned to. And that should have been printed and placed in a notebook or a trial site binder that is only accessible, again, by the person that randomized them and those that are working on the side of the blind. That didn't happen. It wasn't kept in a place that it should be. And ultimately what ended up happening is that randomization scheme or that drug assignment was placed in every clinical trial participant's chart. And when I say chart, Ventavia used paper. And this is not atypical, you know, but we have in my industry moved towards more paperless you know, way of conducting the trials. But Ventavia was all paper. Any data that was collected during a patient's participation, their height, their weight, their medical history, their surgical history, you know, their physical exam, was all captured on paper. At that point, it's transcribed manually into Pfizer's database. So everything, again, the charts that we had, you know, were all paper. And this randomization scheme placed in a chart. So if the patient were to call in with an adverse event or an illness during their participation, and the investigator wanted to look at their chart, he would find that, you know, the unblinding piece. So he would know, or she would know, that the patient was either assigned placebo or vaccine, which could ultimately affect, you know, the way that this particular patient was managed.
Yeah,
in terms of
You're talking about how the patients are scored with respect to those adverse events. The entire reason why patients, investigators are blinded is so that there's not some unconscious bias, right? So there may be intentional bias, which is fraud, but even if there's unconscious bias, it's just slop. And so that is very, very disturbing. So, you know, we have to blind ourselves if we're doing true randomized gold standard prospective double blind clinical trial. It's right there in the title. of the clinical trial description. You also have a slew of evidence, and I'm not going to ask you to go through all of the evidence, but you have hard evidence. You took photographs of this on the site. You backed up your assertions with a great deal of evidence. And so you sent a complaint to the FDA, and the FDA, I'll tell you what I think happened, right? The FDA called Ventavia and said, we're going to send a team over to find out what's going on because you guys are messing up. And by the way, they warned Ventavia, don't threaten Brooke, right? Is that what FDA did?
That's the only conclusion that I can draw. There, you know, I don't believe in coincidence anymore. You know, I did exactly what I should have done in taking my findings to the other members of my leadership team and, you know, was told to put things on a list. And that's really what started my documentation of everything that I was finding. You know, I warned Ventavia repeatedly, if we were to be audited by the FDA, there would be official action that's warranted and indicated. And there is the potential that we could be shut down on top of, you know, this is an important time in the world and what's going on with COVID, and data integrity is important, you know, especially right now. Not that it's not ever, but especially now we have to get this right. And, what I saw Ventavia doing to try to cover up some of these, you know, some of this misconduct, and then I take it to Pfizer, although I did that anonymously, you know, they're complicit in this as well. And, you know, at that point, I knew I had to take it to the FDA. So that's exactly what I did. And about 6 hours later, after filing my complaint with the FDA, Ventavia fired me under the pretext that I was not a good fit.
Right. And instead of doing the right thing, which is to say, we have a real data steward, a data safety management person here. Let's put her in that position. She's going to hound dog all of us into shape here, and we're going to change our ways. They decided to ignore these problems. Do you have evidence that they actually destroyed any physical evidence of the problems?
Yes, I do.
Great. So you are currently a litigant, are you not?
Yes.
With the defendants being Ventavia and Pfizer?
The defendants are Ventavia Research Group, Pfizer, and the contract research organization that Pfizer delegated some of their clinical trial responsibility to. And that's ICON.
Yeah. So the incredible thing is that mainstream media really hasn't followed through with their social commitment, the social contract, if we trust them with the news. This to me would be, look, people, if this is happening in one little research site and Pfizer is intaking data and including the data from these sites, it's happening elsewhere. That's the concern, right? Whether it's whether it's happening because of it's a mad rush to get the science done, due to the rush on the program, or it's happening because it's kind of like double fold there. There's a mad rush, so they're going to go with second rate companies. I don't know, but to get the enrollment, I understand that you also had people that were signing up their friends and past co-workers from the Taco restaurant. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yes. When I started going through resumes, you know, of the staff, and I did that pretty early on because I wanted to know who was working at Ventavia. And as I start going through these resumes and I'm looking at our unblinded vaccinator, who also doubled as our receptionist, that was a red flag for me. So that's really what prompted me. She was one of the very early resumes that I looked at, and she had no medical experience at all. In fact, you know, she was younger and, you know, had retail experience and restaurant experience. And her latest position was the lead cashier at a taco restaurant. And I brought that to the attention of, you know, the managing members of Ventavia, and, you know, was told to put it on a list again, and that they were working hard to bring in people that were more qualified. And
So the Department of Justice, you had hoped that they might come along with you and protect the public's interest in this. And tell us about the letter you received from the Department of Justice.
Oh, yeah. So after I realized, once I contacted the FDA, and the FDA contacted me on September 29th, so about 4 days after I filed the complaint, and I spoke with an Inspector Cannon for over an hour. She was, you know, I felt very engaged in the conversation. She showed empathy towards my being, you know, fired after reporting what I did. I gave her very detailed information about the misconduct and in my mind, what I felt was so egregious. That conversation ended. And a few days later, I was actually contacted on my personal cell phone by Pfizer's own attorney, who, when I asked how he received my cell phone number and how he knew my name, he gave a kind of a scary response and told me that he got it from somebody that I'd made this anonymous complaint to, and that he and others were just very interested in getting my story and finding out what was going on at Ventavia. So I quickly ended that conversation. I gave what I feel like was enough time for the FDA to, you know, receiver to get in there and at least inspect the clinical trial site. Because like I told the inspector on the phone, if this is happening at this little site in Ventavia, imagine what's going on elsewhere. And when I realized that wasn't going to happen, I knew that I had to become a whistleblower and took my evidence and allegations to the Department of Justice. And immediately, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, and I wish I knew then what I've learned now, because I don't know that I would have become a whistleblower in the sense that I would have filed this type of case, because what that required me to do was keep my mouth shut for a little over a year. The letter that I received from the Department of Justice was sent to me via certified mail, which you're required to sign for. When I received this letter in my mailbox, the letter was opened and it was them declining to intervene in my case.
My goodness. So you never signed for that letter?
No.
How do you know that letter was authentic? Did you authenticate that back with the Department of Justice, and it's not a fake letter that was put in there?
Yeah, so it was authenticated through my attorney, Robert Barnes. When I received the letter, I immediately emailed him pictures of the letter, and I immediately filed, and you know, through the Postal Service, just a complaint. And
obviously. Mm-hmm. So listen, a couple of minutes left. Sure. Brooke, you were helping so many people. You're helping every person on the planet, so far as I can tell. So what can we do to help? Is there a fundraiser for your case anywhere? Is there anything we can do to help at all, other than just spread the news about what your experience and tell us more what we can do to help? Please.
Yeah, I think that's what the only thing that I can do at this point is just keep sharing my story, keep telling my story to anybody who's willing to listen. You know, in terms of fundraising, I'm not doing any of that. I just, you know, that my attorneys have been amazing. I have a new team of, I think 17 plus attorneys who are working with Robert Barnes. That's Warner Mendenhall and several other groups. So yeah, just keep telling the story and allowing me to talk about it.
Great. Well, you have my eternal gratitude, and on behalf of all the listeners of Pulse and everyone on the planet, thank you for being a steward of objective research science. You're a fantastic person. So we'll have you back again, and as the case progresses, maybe you can give us an update, right?
That sounds great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
While many things we hear are lies, we know one thing is true. Viruses exist and people get sick. Look, there's no guaranteed way to keep from getting sick, but there is a way to reduce your chances. Cofix RX, the original povidone iodine-based antiviral nasal spray that you hear Dr. McCullough talking about, provides an additional, invisible layer of protection from colds, flu, coronaviruses, and more. Click the banner ad on AmericaOutloud.com and use promo code OUTLOUD for 20% off. Stay protected with Cofix RX.
The spirit of American liberty and justice is woven into the soul of America Out Loud. Now we invite you, friends, to invest some of your time with our magnificent family of experts, their minds and voices. It's all back at AmericaOutloud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
hygiene hasn't changed in 50 years. Brush, floss, repeat. We're told to use fluoride, which doesn't really address the acid-creating bacteria. That is where the dentist-recommended Spry Dental Defense System shines. Spry products contain xylitol, a natural sugar which helps get rid of those nasty, smelly, acid-creating bacteria in our mouth. The best way to care for your teeth and gums is by using Spry. The Spry Dental Defense System has a wide variety of products, toothpaste, mouthwash, mints, and chewing gums that are designed to work together to keep your teeth clean and mouth healthy and smelling sweet all day long. To get your oral care back on track in an easy, effective, and very tasty way, switch to Spry today. Ask your dentist about xylitol and the Spry products. Spry can be found online and at all fine natural product retailers.
All right, on our next segment, we have March Twisdale. She is the host of the radio program Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, and she is part of humanity's army that is standing up to the technocracy, the oligarchy, whatever you want to call it, those people that would have us consume and digest and become part of their disinformation campaign. March, welcome to The Pulse.
Hey there, thank you so much for having me.
Right, so you're located out in Washington State, as I recall.
Yeah, Vashon Island near Seattle.
Yeah, right, great. So recently a project of yours came to my attention, and it's called the Reporting Hesitancy Project. The Reporting Hesitancy Project, I can guess, but why don't you tell the listeners what motivated this Reporting Hesitancy Project? Why did you conceive of it, and tell us all about it?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Basically, I've got about a 25-year history with the informed consent movement. And so you could say I've got this quarter-century viewpoint of what has been happening with regard to suppressing our awareness of the really important parts of the science when it comes to vaccine medicine. And the suppression, of course, is largely upon the adverse events. If you want everyone to trust your product, then you're going to hide that which is not great about it. So I have that as a background. And then in 2021, I got involved with a few of these really great, what would you call them? I guess basically an email group, Google groups, you know, Pierre Corey and Malone and a few of these other people are on the same groups that I'm on. And so I was on these Zoom calls, and, you know, late 2021 was a period of sort of frustration, lots of talking about concerns, frustrations, but everyone was getting itchy because we wanted projects we could, you know, dig our teeth into. We wanted action we could take. And then I was invited, I'm not sure by who, but to a call that Steve Kirsch had put on with about 30 people. And he said to them, look, if you have a project you want to work on, you know, go for it and we'll try to back you up. And so I just sort of sat there and I thought to myself, you know, I had a couple of false starts, a couple ideas, talked to Toby Rogers and others, and they sort of were like, eh, it wouldn't work for this reason or that. And I agreed with them. And then this idea came to me that everyone seemed to like, which is to attempt to really highlight, discover, dive into, and find the multiple reasons why people are hesitant to report adverse events to vaccine medicine specifically. And I will say it's a bit of a play on words. There's been this vaccine hesitant terminology thrown around. And so I was like, well, we actually have reporting hesitancy. And so that's where the idea sort of came from.
I can totally identify with that. In fact, there are academics who do research on this topic of vaccine hesitancy. They have pathologized it and made it into a mental disorder, which is something I predicted. It's very, very similar to the MO of the CCP that will pathologize anything that you think if it goes against the party's agenda. So, yeah, so that's a great motivation. Mm-hmm. There's underreporting of vaccination. And then, yeah, just take what they're doing and turn it around and say, wait a minute, it's not vaccine hesitancy, it's reporting hesitancy. Let's study that. That's a great idea.
Thank you. And functionally, I'm super curious to see the results. We had planned a specific window of time and we really launched this back in late February, but I happened to be in Southern California when the People's Convoy was taking off from Adelanto and heading to DC. So I took a month and I actually traveled on the ground with the People's Convoy so I could do citizen journalism right there front and center and not be relying upon other people to tell me what was happening. So there was a bit of a delay in me putting out the information about the survey, but we came back from that and Dr. Sam DeBay, who is up in near Ottawa, so he's in Canada. He went ahead and had done an interview with me about this, and he ran it about a week and a half ago. So we're in the final stages of our survey being out there so that people, the survey is, I love the survey. It's absolutely brilliant in my mind because it's not a check a box type of yes or no survey. You get to write your own answers to all of the six questions. So it's not huge, but you get to speak for yourself. And it'll probably be a bit of a bear to go through the data, but I don't care because we're looking for surprises. You and I both, and many people who have been dealing with this issue for the past few decades, we can guess at some of the primary reasons that people hesitate to report, but I don't want to go on guesswork. I want to find surprises. I myself had a situation in my life where I hesitated and I didn't realize it until last year. And then when I realized why I hesitated, I was sort of shocked. So I figure a lot of people might get really surprised. And the survey is written very carefully to not suggest any answers at all, but to create an opportunity for people to self-discover.
Yeah, that's very, very important. So it's a survey study and you're hoping to enroll how many people in this study?
Well, that's not something we're actually able to dictate in advance because we just put it out to the public. We did set it up so it could take like 25,000 responses per minute or something like that. I've got an amazing technical guy on board who is, well, let's just say he's retired because of his amazing success in this field. So he set this thing up so it couldn't basically get jammed up by hackers or anything. It's very well designed. And so I think we're going to close it out at the end of this month. We won't necessarily stop it, but we're going to just take our data and start working with the data set we have.
Excellent. Excellent. So you are looking forward to the results. You're not doing any results peeking at this point. So you're not going to peek under the hood. You're just going to take the results and analyze them as they come,
yes.
Right? So
yes.
Tell me a little bit more about your research team. Who designed the survey again, and who do you have lined up for the data analysis?
Well, initially I connected with a number of people who had been brought together under Steve Kirsch's sort of that one meeting, and there were a bunch of people who were interested. But what we have is there's several stages. So there's the initial creation and then there's getting it out there. So, you know, Sam Dubay and yourself and other people have been sort of on that list of people who will help with promoting this forward so that more people have a chance to participate. Then I have a group of people who are waiting in the wings so that when the data comes out, we're going to go ahead and be able to analyze the data. This is obviously human analysis rather than computer because everyone's writing their answers down. So we know there'll be a bulk of hours that'll have to be put into that, but we believe it's worth it. That's sort of two teams, people I know through the movement who live elsewhere. But then also here on my island, there's some people who got very organized last year when the vax passes and we live in a midnight blue part of the country here, where it was many people were fired in the state by the governor based upon their medical choices. It's been really rough. So we have some people in our island very well organized. I think we'll have some sit downs and just sort of go through the data in groups and, you know, have tea and cookies and try to make a good experience of it. And then eventually this isn't data. Some people seek data because they want to weaponize it. And I use that word with intention, because even if you're being a nice person, you can still be wanting to weaponize data. My purpose for the data that we're gathering is I see it as enlightenment data. And it's not data we're going to own or control. As soon as we have been able to really write it out and be very clear in presenting what we've learned and then what we've discovered, we will make it distributable to all the different groups that are out there trying to work specifically with people who are injury groups, those who are working on the phones, who are calling people or answering questions, things like that. And we're just going to make this available to them in hopes that it will help those who are advocating on behalf of the injured to be more effective at empowering those people and encouraging them to speak up.
Yeah, that's absolutely brilliant. So we know that underreporting occurs in general before COVID at a rate estimated between
yes.
1 in 10%. And we can see that there's been far more reporting in about COVID 19 associated adverse events.
Right.
The official analysis by guys like Tom Shimabukuro out of Kaiser Permanente with the VSD found no adverse events or deaths associated with or that could be attributed to COVID-19 vaccines. This was reported to the FDA in mid-July last year, and then 2 days later, FDA issued their warning on myocarditis. So the current system is definitely broken.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not analyzing data with respect to adverse events that are occurring, but rather trying to get under the get between the ears of the people that should be reporting. And my understanding of the way that vaccine adverse event reporting is supposed to be done is that doctors are supposed to report adverse events that follow vaccination, regardless of whether they personally or professionally think that the vaccine caused it. So do you think you're going to be getting responses from physicians who are supposed to be reporting this?
You know, I do actually believe that we will get responses from several different types of demographics. And I happen to know some people already who work in the medical field who have filled out the survey. So it's also important to keep in mind. So the survey has a couple of links at the bottom, for example, and it goes to two Substack articles that I've specifically created as supports for people after they take the survey. And we cover Australia, New Zealand, United States, Canada, the UK, and the EU in the survey. And what I mean by that is that all of those Western civilization, right, parts of the world, they all have their own unique system. So, you know, you've got the yellow card system and all this different stuff. So at the bottom, you know, one of the links goes to a Substack that specifically says, all right, I've gone through all your countries and here's who you need to talk to in your country. Here's a link. Here's what your doctors are obligated to do. So that's all laid out in one of those articles. And so we try to make the survey as accessible to primarily English speaking, even if it's not their first language, because I did not translate it into multiple languages. So this is something that's going on outside of just the VAERS system in the United States of America, of course. And we really are under sort of, there's a global affront. We need a global response. So I'm attempting to reach many different regions.
Right. I think that's wise. There's an added benefit to raising awareness of underreporting, of course, which is to activate people to be aware of the problem of underreporting.
Mm-hmm.
Without looking at the data, though, what do you suspect some of the reasons are that people, refuse to report or are reluctant to report or have reporting hesitancy?
Well, I'm going to tag back real quick to something you mentioned earlier, and then I'll answer that question directly. You were talking in the very beginning sort of about how vaccine hesitancy, which is that other thing, sort of that negative term that's been coined, has been used to sort of, it's been pathologized, right? And studied and all this stuff. And I'm wondering if you remember, I don't think it was during our conversation in March of 2020. I think it was May of 2020, I became aware of it. But it was this big university study that was done into how are we going to get people to overcome their vaccination hesitancy, and what would be the ways of getting people to choose to take these COVID injections. And they listed out like 10. And what was really interesting, and I bring this up because it applies directly to the question you just asked, is if you want to know why people are hesitant to do something, you might also want to know how they are being pressured, because hesitancy can sometimes be the exact reflection of the pressure. So that study that came out was like, first, we're going to tell people it might save them from COVID. But then there was number two was guilt. Number three was like maybe love. Number four was shame. Number five was community obligation. Number six was get back to normal. Number seven was, and they went through, right? And many of these things were, they literally published this. They were like, hi, here's how we're going to shame, embarrass, and coerce people on their inside emotional level so that they would feel these feelings of guilt and all this other stuff. And they were doing this on purpose. They're blatant about it. So you take that awareness of this was so incredibly intentional. So the suppression is intentional, right? The attempt to make people hesitant is intentional. So now I'll answer the question. Many of the reasons given typically by people who are hesitant, we'll start with them. This is the funny one. The people I know who are in the medical world, this is when they typically say to the survey, people don't even know about it. So we have just basically lack of knowledge. A lot of people, you say, what's VAERS? And they go, I don't know what's VAERS. Like, they don't know. And people like us who are involved, we're so familiar, we forget how many people don't know. So there's just lack of knowledge. When it comes to people who are doctors, nurses, they've always come under pressure pretty much in our system for the past 60 years, whenever they suggested that an injury might be caused by specifically vaccine medicine. That pressure was escalated by 1,000 over the past year. People were scared of losing their jobs, obviously. In the state of California, a couple of years ago, they passed legislation that pediatricians in the state of California are only allowed to give out like 5 medical exemptions a year. And if they give out more than that, they automatically come under suspicion and they are like, they're threatened with the loss of their license. And there's this, and that's like in the legislation that was passed. Well, that means when your patient number 6 in the month of October suddenly has a horrible reaction to their childhood immunization, and you're like, oh, gee, sorry, I'm only allowed to honor the first 5 of you. You know, you're just, I just can't mention it. You know, the lack of medicine in that legislation is appalling. So you have professional fear. Then you have the people who believe that they maybe just drew the short stick and that that's okay, because if they tell anyone, someone else might not get the COVID injection, then they might catch COVID, then they might die, and it'll be my fault because I scared them off of the injection. Now, that actually is a big piece of probably why we have famous people, you know, actors and athletes and stuff who have, they know they've suffered from the injections, but they're not going public, because you don't want to have the famous baseball player who goes public and a bunch of kids suddenly freak out, right? So we have that. I mean, and I can go on. One of the things we're looking for in the survey is the bell curve. So we are going to try to identify, you know, the 2% on either end, but also what are the bulk most often mentioned reasons? Because when we invest our energy in trying to put out messaging that will help to correct this, we may want to put more energy into messaging that's going to, you know, deal with the most prevalent problems. But that's just a few.
Well, it sounds like you're going to have a robust data set, something to interpret, and then, you know, base the description of what you found objectively. And that's very important. So, March, what I wanted to do in the last minute here, to have you tell people how they can participate in your project.
Yes, absolutely. And I will say that taking the survey itself has actually surprised everyone I know who's actually done it. They themselves have been like, oh, that made me think of something that I didn't think of before. So I believe that from the survey onward, we have initially a positive effect, and then there hopefully will be ripple effects as people get connected and get the information they need. And so let's see. First of all, if you find me on Substack, the name of my Substack is Our Thoughts Matter. And that's where you'll be able to find some of this information. Otherwise, I believe, will you offer a link in the description?
Yeah, if you send us a link, we'll put it in the show description for sure.
Great, I'll give you the survey link. It's really easy to remember. It's survey.marchtwisdale.com. My tech guy actually wanted to link it to my name because that's what most people know me by. That's also my website, marchtwisdale.com.
All right, so go to survey.marchtwisdale.com and check out the Substack, which you said was Our Thoughts Matter at Substack.
Exactly.
And March, I want to thank you for being part of the Pulse.
Oh, absolutely. I love what you do, and I'm so glad you're doing it.
All right, have a super night.
All right, thank you.
Hi, everyone. Dr. James Lyons-Weiler here, host of America Out Loud Pulse. I wanted to take a moment and encourage you to stop over at ipak-edu.org. That's ipak-edu.org, and check out the fantastic courses that we have. Our students come out of our courses thoroughly educated on the fundamentals and the essentials of our increasingly complex technological and biological world. Check it out, ipak-edu.org. Come on over to IPAC-EDU and join the community.
Here on America Out Loud, we emphasize optimal health, and air is the most essential element for life. The average person inhales over 35 pounds of air every day, yet we seldom think about how to rid the air of pathogens swiftly and safely when we need to. The Genesis Fogger Plus HOCL is the only way to quickly and naturally restore air to its optimal condition. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud for a free ebook on everything you need to know about HOCL and receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep can be infuriating. Your mind races, you toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's digital age makes it even harder. You're not alone with this struggle. Poor sleep affects over 70% of Americans. Even the Centers for Disease Control label insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. To take back your sleep, HealthyCell has created REM Sleep, the only sleep supplement made to support all 4 stages of human sleep with calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support. Delivered in a patent-pending, pill-free, ultra-absorption microgel formula that tastes great. Fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Well, for our next segment here on Pulse, I'm honored and thrilled to have with us IPAC EDU faculty member, epidemiologist writ large, Kathy Stein. How are you doing today, Kathy?
Great. Thank you for inviting me today.
Right. So I don't know if you people have noticed out there, but vaccine safety science and vaccine efficacy science is a big, important part of your life now. Have you noticed? And what Kathy is expert at, as am I, is the design of clinical trials and other kinds of studies that are usually done on populations, that's what epidemiologists do, to try to assess whether there's an association or a correlation or whether a particular factor may be a contributing potential causal factor in health outcomes, et cetera, et cetera. And so I thought I'd bring Kathy on and talk about some of these variables and things that affect scientific studies, decisions that are made in both the design, the data representation, and in the analysis of those data, and how they can be used for good or for evil to change the results of a study. So, Kathy, I think everyone has heard of randomized clinical trials, but what's so special about randomized clinical trials? Why can't we just, you know, grab 1,000 people off the street and, you know, ask them a bunch of questions? Are you vaccinated, not vaccinated? Have you had this? Have you had that? You know, have you had any kind of neuromyelitis or whatever the outcome is that we're interested in? Why can't we just ask people and then write down their numbers and analyze it and assess causality?
I mean, so there's two reasons. One, the goal of randomization is to try to make groups as similar as possible so that you don't have issues of confounding. And we can talk about confounding more if you want, but the idea that you want everything to be equal and all, you know, everything about the two groups to be as similar as possible so that you're not seeing an effect or missing an effect due to things like age or comorbidities or ethnicity or anything like that. So that's the goal. Whether or not that always works is another question, but at least that's sort of the ideal. And then the other thing about randomized trials is often they can be blinded or double blinded with the goal of you don't want to, you know, if you have, you don't know who's getting the placebo and who's getting the treatment so that patients aren't biasing themselves by their behavior, their adherence. Same thing when it's a double blinded study with the study personnel, they're not treating their patients differently based on whether they know they got the treatment condition or they didn't get the treatment condition. With the blinding, it's supposed to remove bias. Sometimes that's hard to do depending on what the intervention is. But anyway, that's why it's the ideal. And it's almost gotten to the point in the literature, and I'm going down a rabbit trail here, where people say, there's some people in the field, not in the field, but in the public that think, well, if it's not a randomized clinical trial, it's no good. And frankly, there are certain studies you just can't do as a randomized clinical trial. So lots of epidemiologic studies are good. We shouldn't be, you know, crowning the randomized clinical trial as the only thing, but it might be the best way we have to evaluate whether or not a treatment is working or effective.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm an ecologist by training, and I took graduate courses in statistics as well as in research study design for the purpose, the express purpose of understanding it for ecology. And of course, you can't do historical experiments. You can't randomize which rabbits are going to eat which, you know, vegetable matter in the wild. It's just impossible to actually randomize. You can try to control for it, but okay, so randomization is supposed to equalize all the variables that and all the aspects or attributes, characteristics of people that are in the two groups that are in comparison. And you mentioned something important, that randomization does not always work. So, you know, there's a certain risk that you might get some assignment to a group that's not randomized. And when I was at the University of Pittsburgh, I was very enamored with matching criteria across the group. It's still a form of randomization. And so when I teach the class how to read and interpret scientific study, we go into some of the literature beyond randomization by Michelle Eichen, a person I find was very genius. It's so computationally simple to, you know, check the age, the smoking status, you know, whether the woman had babies or not yet, and find their twin while randomizing. And that can reduce a lot of the unintentional confounding and reduce the overall variation if it's related to the outcome. But, you know, when we see these studies in first of all, you would agree that the study should be peer-reviewed before we make any clinical decisions about them, right? So when you see studies coming out from Moderna and Pfizer, and yeah, they might be randomized, but, you know, they define their groups according to whatever criteria they decide, for instance, in the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccination studies, we noted that they didn't really analyze all the data. They left out people from the placebo group and they left out people from the vaccinated arm who developed COVID before the second shot. And this is how they got to 95% efficacy. And I wrote an article that said, no, you shouldn't do that. You should keep all those people in, because in the real world, people are not left out of the vaccination program if they get COVID after the second shot. They really, truly exist. And so if there's a risk of, you know, say some sort of short-term immunosuppression by the vaccine, and then we're likely to get COVID, we would want to know that on safety profile. And so defining these clinical groups, could you give us some examples in vaccine or non-vaccine studies and epidemiology in general, where, you know, the researchers have control over the definition of the groups that are being studied and where that can go right and go wrong?
And I think one of the important points about that is that, you know, with clinical trials, you are supposed to define everything before you start the trial, right? When you design the protocol, when your protocol is approved by the governing bodies, the ethical review bodies, those things are supposed to be predefined. So it's not like you can change, you're not supposed to change midstream and then say, oh, well, you know what, we're not attaining that outcome. Let's try for this other one instead. So that needs to be, you know, sort of stated. But it is.
Let's back up on that point, because it's a very important one, because the first outcome that they wanted to show was that it reduced deaths or reduced hospitalizations. Mm-hmm. And then in a kind of sliding scale, they moved the goalposts to, well, reduced symptoms, or maybe it just reduced the severity of COVID, or maybe it just produced antibodies instead of having any clinical effect whatsoever. And so now this is a weakening of the evidence in that sliding scale of the outcome, isn't it?
Well, and not only is it that, but I think... For the both in terms of, you know, public health policy development for and for the public's understanding, you know, you don't think of a vaccine as I'm taking this vaccine because I don't want to die from the infection. I mean, I think at least the public, like normal human beings, they're not going to the store. They're like, you know, well, this vaccine is going to allow me to get sick, but maybe I won't get quite as sick. People don't think that way. And so I think there was a lot of confusion with COVID in the beginning, like, well, this, I don't know how many times I've seen tweets and comments from, you know, government officials. Well, if you get this vaccine, you're not going to get COVID. Like, number one, I'm on a rabbit trail, but number one, the vaccine studies were not designed that way. And number two, there isn't a single vaccine out there that has 100% efficacy. So number one, it's important to have a really clear definition with no gray area. Like that's true with epidemiologic studies. It's true with, you know, with clinical trials. And so as long you have to, and it has to be something that's clinically actionable and meaningful.
Absolutely. So with group definitions being plastic, you can change your groups as you go. You shouldn't do that. And then the outcomes need to be fixed. And the organization that's supposed to have oversight of this would be an independent institutional review board, someone that doesn't benefit from the outcomes of the study. And there's a panel of scientists and physicians that look and make sure it's all done ethically and correct. So, you know, that's what we do at IPAC. We always have an IRB, even if it's something like a survey study. I'm not going to invite any problems. So, so manipulating the outcomes of a study is also known as p-hacking, especially if you analyze the data multiple times. And we haven't really seen that per se overtly where they've been caught analyzing the data multiple times. However, you know, the actual case definitions have changed in the small randomized clinical trials. There was one guy that came back to life in one of the vaccine studies who died on the vaccine arm and somehow was resurrected over time, and they updated it. But I wanted to ask you, how important is it that we stop doing science by press release and we actually demand that the vaccine studies go out for peer review first?
Oh my goodness. Yes. I think that's been, I think that is the most accurate way to describe what's been going on with COVID, is that it's been science by press release and not actual science. I'm going to keep that phrase, but I get nervous a little bit about peer review, because one of the things I think we've seen with COVID is we've seen, first of all, I've seen papers get published that had, I don't think there was any peer review at all done. Like, it was just really obvious that there was no copy editing done. The abstract would state something and it wasn't backed up by any data in the paper, but because the abstract said it got into a higher impact journal. Whereas some of the really good science done by guys like, you know, Martin Kulldorff and Jay Bhattacharya, those got relegated to lower tier journals because they didn't keep up the paradigm, you know, the narrative. And so I think, and I'll just be really honest here, before COVID, I was a big believer in peer review. I think it's, you know, it's as objective as we could get. But I think when the peer reviewers are already biased and they already have their ideas about what, and frankly, we've seen this as, I've seen this as a scientist, where I've had papers rejected. Well, I don't think it works that way, so it's a bad paper and I'm rejecting you. Or my idea of how this works doesn't fit, and so I'm giving your grant a bad score. So, but it always, that always kind of washed out in the end. I feel like it's not washing out anymore, because your preconceived notions are going to affect how you read the paper, how you read the results of a study. And, you know, and we saw this a ton of times with COVID, and it was terrible. And so I agree that we should have, you know, but I think the other thing about the peer reviewers is they can't have any skin in the game, whatever that is.
It's very important that the editors in chief's positions be questioned if they start assigning reviewers that have conflicts of interest. That's a big no-no. And I agree that the system of peer review is broken, but it's not as though it's not fixable. I mean, it can be corrected. There can be a random pool process. I mean, we're expert at randomization. Why don't we have a random pool process as opposed to, you know, I'm an editor in chief. I know what it's like. You go to someone, you ask them if they have time. Yes, they have time. You know, I try to ask them if they have conflicts of interest, but it's on them to report it if they do. But it's so bad. It got so bad with COVID that they would just put out a press release. And, you know, these press releases were very optimistic. And they're supposed to, the initial two or three that were put out by Pfizer and Moderna, they were put out as press releases, and they're supposed to be labeled forward-looking statements, according to the SEC. And they failed to do that. When a company puts out any announcement whatsoever, and it says that it has the possibility, it's a public announcement, a press release, and it has the impact of driving their stock or the value of their stock up, they have to put in these statements that says, this is a forward-looking statement. Some of what we say might not be accurate. And I pointed this out to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He, you know, said he was going to look into it for us. But later on, they started doing that after I made it public on Twitter. Hey, you know, you guys are supposed to be putting these warnings to the public. But this isn't science. This is a press release. And so the other thing that bothers me about the way that we're doing science these days is these preprint, where preprints are given as much credence and they're cited in studies that are peer reviewed. They're not ever peer. They're never undergo peer review. One of the worst examples of that was the very small studies that were done by Pfizer and Moderna on antibody dependent enhancement. They had, you know, 7 or 8 monkeys. Pfizer removed one of the monkeys as an outlier based on a strange outcome. Right. And they were only published as preprints. And then public health policy was based on the preprint that was never peer reviewed. Mm. It was absolutely ludicrously, you know, bad evidence. It was weak, weak evidence. So, you know, what I want to do in the last little bit of time that we have here is I'm really excited to let the listeners know that you and I are teaming up. You come over to IPAC-EDU as an instructor in a summer workshop. This is a boot camp on the math of vaccine science. So when you're reading a vaccine science study, well, not you, but when the public's reading a vaccine science study, or when they hear about it in the news, they'll sometimes hear some statistics like relative risk or odds ratio. And it's important to me that the public understand what those mean and whether those measurements, the statistical analyses were done appropriately. So let's just talk briefly about why you said yes to this challenge to help me teach this course, and what do you think the students are going to get out of it?
And for one, I took on the challenge because I wanted to get my feet wet in IPAC-EDU. And I love the idea of IPAC-EDU because it's educating people who actually want an education rather than, you know, I mean, I think my students now, at the undergrad level are taking the class because they want to, but there's a little bit of that resistance, right? But, you know, I'm excited to teach people who actually really want to learn, are really interested. I know over the past couple of years of COVID, I found myself reading papers and then putting out lay translations of them on social media. And I know people really appreciated that because I know how to read a study. It's like you said, science has been done by press release. But when you actually dig into the paper and you read between the lines a little bit and you think more about the implications of how the study was designed, how the data were analyzed, then you see things that aren't in that press release or even, you know, not even in the abstract of the paper. And so I think that's one of the really critical things about, you know, explaining to the, you know, empowering the public to know how to read a study so that they can, you know, they can find these details out for themselves. And then, you know, when the latest greatest vaccine trial or observational study hits the media, they can go back to the paper and say, well, actually, no, it doesn't say that. It actually says this. Or you forgot to mention this really important point about like adverse reactions or subgroup analyses or things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So listen, this is a really important third leg on the courses that we offer in analytics. I offer the course a very popular course, How to Read and Interpret a Scientific Study, where people can come and learn the different types of studies. You mentioned a retrospective study, there's prospective studies. This can be very confusing to the uninitiated. And so, you know, we do get into the math a little bit there, but I also teach introductory spreadsheets, and we use some of the math and vaccine science that are there so people have something to operate on as they're learning their spreadsheet skills. But in this course, when you hear, you know, odds ratio or adjusted risk, and you read the word confound error, you're going to be given the experience of two, not one, but two people that have a lifetime of experience of analyzing complex data sets, large data sets with health outcomes. And so I'm absolutely thrilled that you said yes, Kathy. And I just want to point people to the website at ipac-edu.org. ipac-edu.org, you do not need a very sophisticated math background. In fact, if you made it through 9th or 10th grade in high school with your math, we could do a lot with you with this course. And she's shaking her head vigorously. I know this is audio only, but she's got a big smile. She's like, this is not complicated stuff, people. There are complicated methods, right? And we're going to be doing some more, you know, higher level courses on those methods. And we're going to get into some of the issues that some of those other complicated methods bring. But Kathy, I want to give you a minute here. And, you know, I want to thank you. I'm going to let you have the last word on, you know, why should people take this course?
And I think it's, again, you're talking about, sometimes I think people get this idea that the math and stuff underlying vaccine science is really complicated, this black box. Like a lot of it, like you're talking about 9th and 10th grade math, this is literally fractions. And as long as you understand the intuition of how these things are set up, it's not hard. And so I think it's sort of removing a veil that, you know, everyone thinks, well, you can't understand this because you don't have a fancy degree. Like, yes, you can. And I think it'll be great to really, like I said, empower people, especially with so much, you know, the way that these studies are affecting our everyday lives. I think it's so important that people understand what actually goes into them and that it's not really a black box.
Absolutely. It'll make all the studies more transparent to you. You'll be able to better understand things, not just about vaccines, because the same methodology is used studies in pharmacology and pharmaceuticals, for the outcomes for, you know, cardiovascular drugs and everything else. So, Kathy, you're a gift to us. Thank you. We're so lucky to have you. Looking forward to talking with you soon.